Good morning, everybody. Today is Tuesday, October 1st, 2019. We're gathered for general discussion in the Board of County Commissioner Conference Room. All three commissioners are present. We're going to start with Jim Goodwin, our juvenile director, with a juvenile justice quarterly update, mainly because not everybody else is here yet for this meeting. And so Jim is here, so we're going to take you first.
Sounds good.
Morning, sir.
Morning. Well, first, I got a buck on Sunday, so.
You did?
Yay. So you're done hunting.
You can all relax.
Big one, right. Little one?
Big, very big body, but kind of a mutant rack. A big fork on one side, a real heavy, weird one on the other side,
wow.
And a big flat paddle, like an eye guard, yeah.
That would be just the stuff that was. Just to look at it.
Yeah. So, sorry.
It's supposed to fill the fridge, right?
Yes, that's
congratulations.
A good
thing. Congratulations. Where did you get it? Just that offhand. Right behind the French holders?
Just about. Not very far from the lease.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good for you. Great job.
Yeah. So, we've been busy over there at Juvenile Justice. I'll start with the prevention program that has been, we finally got it 100% staffed. We have an outreach position in all three county high schools, Illinois Valley, North Valley, and Hidden Valley. They also cover the middle schools that feed those schools. The sheriff did bring on, I've met one time with, they have one school resource officer on, that I guess right now is covering kind of the whole county. Hey, Nate.
Okay.
And we had a very good, sheriff have had a ton of, well, I won't say turnover, but he has patrol now, and all new faces. And so my detention manager and I hit both shift changes last week just to go over our procedures, how we interface with the sheriff's office, how we can be a resource to them. I think there was a lot of confusion out there since they were minimally staffed and then we were down for all those years, exactly what can happen with a kid that they come in contact with. Very productive meetings, and I think we're on the same page going forward with that. But and then having said that, we still have our position at Grants Pass High School, North and South Middle, staying with prevention. The school districts are
that position is open, or
extremely
is it
open? I mean, it's filled. Yes, the districts are extremely happy. Just one little anecdotal thing from last year at the end of the school year. The principal at Illinois Valley High School, so the team out there would be their VP, the mental health therapist from Options, our school outreach person, and then hopefully an SRO that's there now. They weren't really there before, but they're so strapped for staffing out there. The principal actually said he was a very confident man and doesn't necessarily go looking for reasons to compliment outside agencies. He said, and I thought this was the biggest impact, that team, the therapist and our outreach person, he says he could count 10 kids that would not have gotten across that stage were it not for those positions. They're on the bubble. They're on the verge of dropping out. They're on the verge of getting kicked out. You know, or go do something else, and their resources have just been so depleted that he said that in a room full of professionals, and it was really, that was impactful to me, because he's saying that's how much we value that they did not have the time or the energy or the resources to devote to these super high needs kids that probably would have just washed out and not graduated. And so That's their level, and Superintendent Dave Valenzuela out there shares the same optimism and success that we had last year, and really looking forward to.
Dave actually is looking to get us some numbers from Three River School District. He says that because they haven't had a full year yet, because it started after the school year started, but they can get us numbers on the impact of And statements like, they don't know how they ever did it without these partners. And
well, they didn't do it without the partners. Well, that's pretty much where I'm going. I don't know how we ever did it without it, because you didn't do it without
So, Jim, can you remind us how these outreach officers are funded?
The initially, so we had some carryover this year in prevention that I think, and Arthur's not here, but to supplement it, but the I'm trying to think of which one it was, not the.
So we had the mental health marijuana dollars. So we get pulled from the state on two different marijuana taxes, or when the state collects their marijuana money, they break it down into 10% go to county, 10% to cities, 15% to mental health, 40% to schools, or
10% of the 4% of the 30% of the 12%.
Absolutely. Did you get
that's
that?
That's exactly how it works. I know exactly how it works.
So, end up with an eighth of a percent.
And Josephine County tends to be in the 3% range. So whatever the breakdown for counties, we have about 3% of the population, 3% of the response. It's even that way with community corrections. We're 3% of their pie-ish. Mm-hmm. So, but mental health dollars that came to our county that have to be used for treatment or prevention and stuff like that, those dollars were used to help partner with these school outreach officers. So,
It sounds like a real stew of money coming your way that you have to mix together.
It really is. And then prevention proper. So they had a position before this. So a percentage of beer and wine tax in the state also comes into counties solely for the use of prevention. And there's some discretion there on how it be used, but it's within that. It's within that scope.
Right.
So as that's recession proof, as you know. So those monies stayed fairly stable throughout the years, and was the very beginning. The one position that we had in Grants Pass High School, North and South Middle School, funded through that. So we're really looking forward to having another full year. We're grappling a little bit. You mentioned the superintendent. We're trying to figure out how to measure whether that is maybe graduation rates or whatever. Prevention's really hard, because if you prevent it, it didn't happen. So what are you exactly counting? But we feel like it's really important going forward that we find a couple of measurements that we can say that we can, you know, here it is. This is a true. You know, we don't just think we're doing good measure work, but we've got something to measure here.
Mm-hmm.
It's whether that's assessments coming in pre and post or things like that. But we'll try to lock it into. I think the graduation rate would be one natural place to start.
And I think attendance is another one.
Right, the truancy, the attendance, all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So any questions about the prevention program? Off and running, fully staffed. Hit a few bumps on the road there. It's very difficult finding folks for these positions that have the background and the willingness to do this kind of work. For that kind of money. And then just rolling into detention, we have our first, if you remember, I had a contract before you for a 30-day secure treatment program in detention that I was going to peddle to the rest of the state if we had excess beds in detention to provide a good program and also to make a little bit of money. So we now have our first paying customer, might say, from Crook County. And so what we're finding out is east of the mountains, females specifically, there's very few resources over there. So I've talked with Crook County, Malheur County, Lake County, and a few other ones over there. They really struggle getting treatment services for their girls. And we're a co-ed program, and so they're delighted to have us as a resource. And with even the possibility of transitioning from 30-day detention into our non-secured residential as a step down to go back into the community. So that program is functioning at a very high level. I think we're turning out a fine product with our own county kids that go through it. They come out with a treatment plan, recommendations, All the assessments that they might need, whether it's mental health, alcohol and drug, all of that. They get a high dose of cognitive behavioral treatment when they're in there. And it's just kind of like that quick, as much as you can do in 30 days, because that's all the law says you can do. You only get 30 days.
And you can connect them up to some resources.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
A lot of times it's 30 days clean and sober, which is the longest some of these kids have had in a while.
In their young life.
And that gives them a chance. Nate would probably say with the adult program, it gives you a chance that you don't have otherwise.
Mm-hmm. A little restart.
A little restart out there. So that's off and running, doing very well. Detention, as just a general rule, we are now fully staffed.
Night shift too.
Yeah. No openings. What we struggling with mightily is our part-time on-call pool. Because when you get a part-time on-call worker that works very well for you, the staff know them, management like them, they do a good job. As soon as a full-time opening comes, you pick them up. And then when you're talking about a staff of about 20 people with the PTO, sick time, vacation time that we have, staffing the facility for vacations and sick time and things like that, that would probably be our biggest struggle is recruitment for those positions because, A, the folks are looking for full-time work and are still looking. We pick them up as a part-time on-call, and they get a job somewhere else, and they leave. Or, you know, best case scenario, we pick them up. So,
how much work is there for a part-time on-call? I mean, is it enough that they don't go looking for work elsewhere?
Well, if they really want a job in our field, I mean, we can work them full-time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's non-benefited. It's, you know, you have to kind of
wait. How long does it take to get them onboarded?
You know, it just depends. Usually not long, but then it's usually night shift. You know, it's the first opportunity. So I would say that, you know, that's our biggest, just looking forward, that's our biggest challenge, getting folks in the door to where we're not doing mandatory overtime. Someone calls in sick, we don't have, you know, coverage for that. The 24-hour facility is its own beast to manage. But
sure.
But still, for one of the first times since we've been open, no full-time vacancies. And everybody really, really functioning at a high level.
So do you have any future retirements that you're concerned about filling?
Well, I've got about 9.5 years to get.
You better start planning,
you had
buddy.
Some a couple years ago.
Not that I'm not counting the days or anything. No, we did. You know, not really.
Not really a big cliff horizon for that in your department?
In Court and Field, we kind of had the large exodus, 2 to 3 years ago, where we really turned over almost all of the staff for our probation staff.
Oh.
And we've got a great, that was my next part of the update, just a great, I've never seen our Court and Field services functioning at this high of a level since I've been my 20 years. All the interactions with the court, all the other community partners, they really are killing it right now.
Nice.
And that is the deputy director. Those are his cats to herd. And when we finally made that, because I'm pulled out of the office so much, when we finally just delineated, this is you, manage these folks, you know, and put out a good product, that made all the difference in the world because they meet regularly, they're all on the same page, and they're energetic, and they actually go looking for work, which for you know, can we do this or can we try this or you know, that kind of thing, which is really refreshing and awesome to have.
Sure.
And then, you know, beyond that, I've got a couple meetings in this next week about the CAC and that project. I wanted to meet with Commissioner Morgan first before I brought a possible proposal to the board about pushing that project forward. So that might be in the next week or two.
Okay.
But we're still, I will say that the work that we've done initially with the county's new grant writer has been fantastic. And there's just the quick capstone there. She's very, very optimistic that we can pull in $300,000 to $500,000 for to make both the CASA program for that building once the CAC is out of there, and the new home of the CAC, similar to the program that we saw over in Jackson County. Get the bells and the whistles and everything that you need to do a very good job, and that's all funded through grant opportunities that are out there. So where she's been extremely active, met with her several times. We meet weekly on this project, so that's really going forward.
You might follow up with Annette and find out where the facilities move committee is at, so you have an idea of just kind of what the status is there, because I don't know what's going on with IT's
move. What's the timeline?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we talked about was it's difficult. So what we're looking at is the pre-work that we need to do in order to say, so we apply for this grant. We want A, B, C, and D, because they don't give you money unless you give them all of those bullet points. And so those are all obviously have to be factored in. But maybe even the move we think can be financed through, because it's all one package.
Yeah, it's nice to have a building and one property.
Yes, her, Amber's little stroke of genius was because we are a county government, we're not a 501c3, there's about 70% of the grants that are out there you don't qualify for because you're a government. But with a qualifying partner agency, sort of like Friends of the Fairgrounds, I guess, or something like that, they are a 501c3, but pass through money for projects for county government. We're partnered up with CASA on this so that it's mutually beneficial to both programs to build them up the way that we want them to be. So they can apply as the financial agent for a lot of grants that we can't apply for. So she's also coordinating that deal there. So just a few things to do for the wintertime project.
I have a question.
Yeah.
When we went over to Medford and toured that whole facility, fantastic facility. Mm-hmm. Thought it was great. Didn't see any customers. When do they show up? There was nobody there. There was nobody in the interview room.
We were there.
There was no kids playing on the playground. There was no...
They said that day why. They did say why when we were there. It was either a staff meeting morning or a court morning or something else like that. But they said there was a reason there was no one there that morning.
Hmm. Yeah, because I thought, great, you know, it's all, you know, there's toys for the kids and everything's all designed and, you know, this machine does that and this one takes care of this and this looks at that.
I don't know that they would have let us in if there were customers there.
See anybody. Yeah, maybe that they scheduled it just for that.
It could be that early in the morning.
Is that what you came to tell us, sir?
That is what I came to tell you.
Well, I think congratulations are in order. Didn't you assume a presidency of your statewide organization or whatever they call it last month?
I did. Uh-huh. And so that puts me really into the chairs, president-elect, president, and then past president.
Okay.
It's a 6-year commitment to the state association.
Wow.
When you do that. Joe Ferguson just stepped down as president, so he has 2 years to go as far as being a board member.
Right.
But there are some really exciting things at the state level that we're involved with.
Well, I appreciate you being involved in that, because that helps keep our name, our good name, in front of the state as far as people who are actually solving problems and providing services and not just spending money. So I appreciate you serving on that.
I have a couple questions. We had at some point partnered with Rotary Mentoring, and that is there's an amendment before us that we're going to, I think, Thursday. I asked if we can have that on the Thursday agenda. But are any of our youth, are through the residential program or anything, being able to be connected into that, or can be referred into the Youth Pathways Partnership internship programs? I know that we want to make sure that our youth are getting workforce training as well.
Yeah, they, I think it was Anderson. It's Joe Anderson, is that the right name? Works with Gene on that project. He came and did a presentation right after they fired it up with all our probation staff. And so they do. They're constantly looking at their caseloads, whether a kid's appropriate or not. I don't know if we have anybody in the program right now.
Okay.
But it's part of the array of, you know, services that we refer to. Same as residential. Usually if the kids are, the local kids are the ones that we'll look at for that. And I'm not sure if we've had anyone, a kid through there yet either. But it is. They make that very available to our kids if the need's there.
You're just looking for a candidate
mm-hmm.
that might fit it well.
Yep. Yeah.
And with us housing kids from the east side, what's the impact on the kids as far as connection to family visits? I mean, I don't know where we are with local kids having visits with families, because if they're in a residential, they're probably not at home for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember in prisons, they encourage family visits because it helps why they're in adult prison. I know with OIA, they try to route local people to ours if they can, so they can get visits and stuff. What's with us housing from a few hours away, is that having an impact on these kids having a connection to family or behavior?
Well, you know, the sad fact is a lot of the families that we deal with that live three blocks away.
There's a reason the kid's there.
That literally three blocks away, they don't come and visit their kids in detention.
Yeah.
I would say that the families that are involved, I mean, there are stipends, there's gas vouchers, there's things like that. That is all available, so the engaged family can get over there or get over here and visit their kid. Not a problem at all. It's part of the program. It's encouraged. There's contact between our program coordinator for that program and the parents and the PO from whatever county, and you know the whole thing. So yeah, there's some miles between, but there's no barriers to it, I guess is what I'm saying, other than the time to get over here.
So we're not seeing a lot of it?
No.
But you're not from local people either, so you're not seeing any difference?
Yeah, I mean, and I won't say from all families. I'm just saying it's not uncommon for a kid from right here in Grants Pass or Josephine County not to have a lot of input from the family when they're in detention.
Do they still have a work crew with the youth program?
Mm-hmm. Community service.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay. Any other thoughts?
Not for me.
All righty. Thank you.
Yeah, thank
See you at 1?
Yes.
Take care. Thanks for covering for Nate.
Next up, we'll have Nate Gowron with Community Corrections.
Nate's still on mountain time.
Good morning, commissioners.
Thanks
morning.
For
listening to me today. I have a quarterly report for you. The format is going to be similar to what I've done in the past.
We'll cover
the
logo.
Thank you. We'll cover the significant agency notes right here, and then go into the specific divisions and some of those significant notes over the course of the summer. So these concepts and numbers will be from July, August, and September. Of note, there's going to be one day missing because I wasn't able to pull all of the stats from yesterday in order to prepare this report for today. So, at any rate, there may be just a slight adjustment in the numbers for September 30th. But with the significant agency notes, we conducted a moderate restructure of our personnel, providing some more lead positions throughout the agency in specific divisions, and then also along with some leadership opportunities and expansion of our FTE to a total of now 42 employees. We also entered into a contract with the University of Cincinnati for core correctional practices and correctional program checklist auditing. We sent two of our leaders over to Cincinnati to get trained in the auditing structure for the CPC, we call it, and all of that was funded by leftover JRI state funds that we applied for and were awarded $30,000. So we're using those funding mechanisms for good use for our agency. We also sent four representatives to the American Parole and Probation Training Seminar with those funds. in San Francisco in August, where practitioners and leadership across the country met. We do have representation on the board of directors for the APPA, and they were very appreciative of our participation in the national association. We continued discussion and planning for application process to bring additional behavioral health services to Josephine County through Senate Bill 973, which is now known as IMPACTS, targeting mental and behavioral health issues. There's a number of LIPSC members that are on that particular meeting group and other practitioners and leaders in our...
Is this the formerly Behavioral Health Justice Reinvestment? Or is this different?
Yes. Okay. Yep. Yeah, it's now known as IMPACTS. We are preparing community corrections allotment plan for the biennium and adding congruent language for our local strategic plan for integration into the state plan and future goals. I think the last time that I did my quarterly report, I mentioned that the governor was a little bit critical on the state's collective plans for CCA and that they weren't as transparent as she would like. So what we ended up doing is mirroring our strategic plan goals with our CCA plan in draft form that will be proposed to the LIPSC next week and then going before you as a board probably the following week. We also helped facilitate the application process for justice reinvestment dollars, partnering with our LIPSC in an effort to bring over $2 million to local stakeholders, including victim services. So we'll find out what our award is in the coming weeks for justice reinvestment as well as the supplemental justice reinvestment. Shifting gears down to our divisions, we have parole and probation, field services, and all of those contacts there. Our total population is now over 1,200 with the snapshot as of Wednesday. We had many more office contacts, as you would expect. We had a significant amount of home visits. If you look at our arrests and our sanctions, we're compared to the prior quarters, we're also growing in those stats as well. So our officers are much more active in terms of arrests. We have offender contacts is also growing, and our collateral contacts, which is family members and associates and things of that nature that we're having contacts with. And that is placing a significant burden on our practitioners. As you can see, just I put some historical data here from 2011, average population stayed under 1,000 until 2018, just last year in the average population. And now with a snapshot of 2019, as of Wednesday, we're over 1,200 folks. So there's
nice. It's been a long time.
Yeah, there's a lot going on with our community in terms of public safety. And then, of course, we're at the end of that system. When folks enter into the justice system, we're at the tail end. So once they get out of prison or convicted from courts, we're seeing now that it could be because of the jail levy and some more resources in patrol. Many different factors contribute to that number, but the DA's office is really pumping out cases, and we are feeling a lot of pressure in terms of the workload. So just wanted the board to be aware of that. Yes, sir.
Question?
Yes.
Do you keep any kind of statistics on how many of these, like of the 1,213 of your total population, how of them are local Grants Pass, Josephine County people? Versus how many you adopt from other places that come here, do a small crime, they're in jail, and then all of a sudden they're on your program because they moved down here from the Willamette Valley or from Portland or from Eugene or Salem or anywhere else along I-5 or anywhere else in the state for that matter, California. Do you keep a running tally?
Mm-hmm.
So we know if we're, do we have way more locals that get involved in your program than out-of-state stuff.
Yeah, so it's timely that you asked that question because we had that same inquiry come in just recently. And so I pulled up the stats and in comparison with, let's say, any other jurisdiction, Lane County, Multnomah County, Linn County, anybody else that has some level of responsibility for supervising these folks. And our transfers in, as well as our transfers out from other jurisdictions, they're pretty congruent with other and comparatively speaking to other jurisdictions. So it's not like we're having influx from other transfers out of jurisdiction to us.
And one thing to keep in mind is, say I went over to Medford, I committed a crime in Medford. I will be convicted in Medford court and assigned to probation. They're transferring that to where I live. So nationally, you get supervised where you live, not where you committed the crime.
Okay. That change has been in effect for a long, long time because historically speaking, many of the prisons are in Salem. So when people would get released, they didn't really have any place to go before we had all these resources to get transferred and, you know, bus systems and so on and so forth. So the bulk majority of the people that would get released from prison would stay in that community. Well, the community was like, hey, why don't we...
I didn't see any wrong with that. Sounded okay to me. Good policy. Let's keep up.
So people in Salem said, let's not keep them here. Let's ship them back to the crime
of conviction. Sure, they found money for that quick.
Right. So so that's been the process for many, many years. And,
but I can see where that is. But like Commissioner Morgan was saying, she lives here. She commits a crime over there. You're going to send it back here. But what if I have moved to Medford and I commit the crime over there and I still live in Medford? Say, nope, you got to go back to Grants Pass?
Yeah, we have specific rules now.
Where your home address is, where you are residing.
Right, we have specific rules with through OARs and also in agreements regionally for transfers. So if that ever were to occur, we find the best possible solution to promote their success, and typically it's wherever their residence is. So if they commit a crime in Medford, we're typically going to transfer that case over to Medford if that's where they live. So,
and it depends on if you lived there the day you were convicted or after. So if you moved before you were convicted, then that's your residence on conviction, and you just automatically kind of go when you come out of court. If you move after you've convicted, then we have to go through a transfer process where they evaluate the home and all that kind of stuff in a transfer evaluation.
What about the Justice Reinvestment Act? Is that causing some numbers to go up?
I think there may be some ripple effects going on there. The numbers in and of themselves, there's a lot of things going on. There's the short-term trans leave, the early releases from prison that's happening. We also have an influx in our downward dispositional departures that happened. So folks that qualify to go to prison, if they're a non-person felony, we'll keep them here locally. So usually those folks were going up to prison. So there's a lot of...
There's a few contributors to
that increase. Yeah, and you know, our population is just been growing steadily. So... and if you just boil it down, there's a lot of crimes that are happening in our region. So,
but I think this is the part that people want to see, though. If it's always been, well, we don't have a sheriff's department, I'm not even going to call it in. So there was a lot of crime that went unreported because there was no response to it. And I think now that we're having some response both in the city and in the county, your numbers are going to go up, which I think you mentioned earlier in your report is because, you know, there's more cops on the beat. They're getting more done. So, although this is a bad number in one way, it's a good number in another one. That now, you know, those people got caught. They've been convicted. They went through the DA and the court system, and now they're in your hand. That's a long road to get to you.
Yeah.
Long road.
Yes, sir. That last bullet point on the first page, Senate Bill 910 actually goes into effect today. It passed and removes the POs from having to be gatekeepers on medical decisions for MAT. And I think that also removes the county from a significant amount of liability on both ends, whether you deny somebody MAT and they die because of overdose, or you allow them MAT and they have...
What's MAT?
Medication-assisted treatment. So Suboxone, Vivitrol, those types of...
Methadone,
those types of medications that help people come off of heroin and stay off. Going on to the next page, under treatment services, we now have 118 people enrolled in treatment. And as you recall, a couple of years ago, we shifted our treatment agency to only serve our high-risk population. So they have to go through a number of different visits, assessments, and case planning and treatment planning in order to be in our treatment division. We now have 118. As you can see, that's up about 30 folks from past quarters. We have secure treatment beds that I wanted to call your attention to this, because we shifted back from the females to the males in secure treatment. The past three quarters, we were serving females, and you can see the numbers were a little bit lower than they are now. So I just wanted to call your attention to that there may be a higher need for males in jail than there are for females. And that if you just look at the ratio, it's about a third of the population in jail is female, about two-thirds is male. Our ATIS Dewey assessments, they're up similarly to last quarter, and look for that to increase as well in the next quarter. Some
and
significant
that's anybody that's had a DUI, not just people on supervision.
Correct. Yep. All through the county. That's the amount of assessments that we've conducted. Just a small tangent. We had another jurisdiction that has called us to consult with us on how we actually conduct ATIS assessments here in our county. And I think there's getting more attention to our ATIS process because people find value in it. And I just wanted to let the Board of County Commissioners know that folks are calling us to consult and maybe integrate our concepts and our programs into other jurisdictions. So that was, I felt like that was a compliment to.
How long have we had it? Because sure. It's not very long that it's been at Community Corrections.
Yeah, about 4 years, I think.
Okay.
Something like that.
And it's
yeah.
greatly improved in the process and mm-hmm. the continuity and consistency for community.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be a separate contractor through the courts, and then the courts contracted with Community Corrections.
Hmm. We're in the process of recruiting for the IT position. Thank you for allowing us to do that. That IT position is going to assist in part with the electronic health record for our folks that are in treatment, and they're also going to help with the migration from platform to platform and in the monitoring piece of it as well. We're going to use that position to help with auditing our billing process and hopefully not leave any money on the table, because currently there's some inefficiencies with our current platform, and I think if we move to a new platform that is more relevant, it will increase our ability to bill and not leave any money out there. We're addressing the CPC audit and the findings that we had. Again, we're sitting on two unfavorable audits in our treatment division. Our third one, per statute, we have to no longer accept state funds for our treatment division, which would be a very large hit to our agency. So,
sure.
Strategically, I mentioned earlier in my report that I sent two people over to the University of Cincinnati for CPC auditing purposes. We're going to use all of that knowledge for our internal auditing process before we actually have the state come back in and audit us. So I just wanted you as the Board of County Commissioners to know that if you hear that we had unfavorable audits, the last two consecutive ones, know that there's a plan in place. We're working hard to make those corrections.
And when they do those unfavorable audits, do they give you any hint as to what you're doing wrong?
Yes. Okay. Yes, they do. Yeah. And that's what we're addressing aggressively and making some internal changes. So
do they have a program to where you can say, yeah, come on down to OSHA and deal with OSHA in the private sector, and everybody thinks OSHA just shows up and they find you and they walk away. But OSHA has a section that you can call and say, leave your ticket book in the truck and tell me what I'm doing wrong. Mm-hmm. I know there's something here that I'm missing. Mm-hmm. You tell me.
Yeah.
And they'll come in and assess everything, hand you a checklist and say, you know, appreciate you calling us ahead of time. They don't want the citation. Mm-hmm. They don't. That's not what they're there. Everybody thinks OSHA's there just to fund the state, and it's not. It's to keep workers safe. So that's why I was wondering if they have a program like that that you can call and say, you know, leave your... I'm not under audit, but I want to know, why do I get dinged? And they...
Yeah, I wish they did. Their CPC staff is made up of two full-time positions for the entire state. So they don't have the time to consult. They don't have the time to follow up. Thank you, sir. With us.
I kind of like the light bulb, the big light bulb.
Yeah, it's shiny, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it's the interrogation room.
Right. So they don't have the resource to consult with us on a weekly, even monthly basis.
Right.
And a lot of times when we send inquiries up there on, hey, will this satisfy this finding? It's crickets. We get no response. Mm-hmm. And I think because... they're just so slammed. There's two people that actually do it for the entire state. Every treatment agency in Oregon that are receiving CCA funds, Community Corrections Allotment funds. So they're very busy, and we get that. They've put it in the reports. We're aggressively taking steps to make sure.
We're bottom of the ninth, full count.
Yes.
And we've got one more swing of that bat, or right. We're out of a lot of money. And I don't want to guess as to what we did wrong or where our drawbacks are on this.
I would say that Oregon Health Authority, who does the assessments, has not been the most consistent agency when it comes to helping agencies understand what to do and how to change. I would also say there's different criteria of... I would say it's not entirely us, but we do want to respond. But... I mean, we can make a list of things that Oregon Health Authority has not been consistent on, but we're all at their mercy. And, you know, there's programs...
You're saying we could do everything they ask, and they send a different guy down, and they go, sorry, that's not what I'm looking at.
Or they have, their newest assessors are maybe not even treatment people. They're a different field that are trying to assess things they've never dealt with before.
Just to provide some clarification... OHA, in terms of our credential to provide services, that's a different audit.
Okay, this is the CJC or the...
This is the criminal...
DOC one.
The Department of Corrections. So OHA has given us our credentials, and we're fine with OHA.
Okay.
This is a different audit, and it is all about evidence-based practices, and I think it was born out of Senate Bill 267 that said we have to provide... evidence-based programming, otherwise the state will not fund you to do that. So in OARs, they've created this auditing process called the Correctional Program Checklist, and it was developed by the University of Cincinnati. Ed Letessa was instrumental in doing those things. So now we are fully trained. I've got the state on board to give us the credential for Denise Olson and Scott Hyde to be CPC auditors for the entire state. So now we're going to use that knowledge to bulletproof our treatment division. So the next time they come, which is scheduled for May of 2020, we're going to be there. We're going to get to the point where there's going to be no findings. That's my goal. So I just want you as a board to have confidence in we're going to get there. We're going to pass it.
Well, and the treatment programs were evidence-based practice at some point. I know breaking barriers is one that it's required for drug court, and drug court actually partners with facilitating it. But we've had more people go through that program and said that's made a difference in their lives as far as helping them change thought patterns and different things. But the state doesn't acknowledge it as evidence-based. And I don't know why. But
I think it helps everybody in the room.
It does.
It's not just the sick people that are up there.
Yeah.
You turn around, you look at the folks that are behind you that are crying because you've saved somebody's
But life. A class called Breaking Barriers that they do in drug court, I was a facilitator for almost 4 years, and I learned something about myself every time I did it.
Yeah.
Because it was based on life truths. And so if you're helping people with their thought process, but the state doesn't consider that evidence-based. But it's making a difference
those
in lives.
Those cold-hearted.
Yeah. Big government.
Yeah, so, right, anecdotally, we're making a huge impact. I mean, you talk to anybody that has gone through some of these programs, and it has been a positive experience, typically.
The certifier that Nate has sent his folks to is the standard nationwide. University of Cincinnati is the leading.
Well, that's what he said, you know, that they're the ones that wrote all the rules, so you send your people to the rulemaker, and you're going to get it firsthand. You're not going to get it through.
That's a really cool thing that you guys are doing to turn that around, because I was curious what you did.
Money well spent. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yeah, and just to emphasize, that was not county dollars that we spent to send them to Cincinnati. It was carryover funds from the Justice Reinvestment out of the state pocketbook. So. We use those things efficiently. The next bullet point down, and we're currently in... I already stated that. Let's go to the last bullet point. Participate in an Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission's effort to develop a statewide strategic plan for prevention, treatment, recovery, and resources. We have a commissioner that's on that particular commission, and I wanted to just let you know, we had Sean Martinez participate in one of the regional meetings that the ADPC conducted in Douglas County, and the message that she gave was heard, in that there has been an emphasis on treatment and recovery for the past couple of years that the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission has really focused on. Well, now, because of Sean and her voice and others like her who are saying, hey, what about prevention? Can the state focus a little bit more on prevention? And the executive director, Reginald Richardson, he heard that loud and clear. So did Chair Block out of Multnomah County, heard that loud and clear. And so now there's going to be a little bit more of a shift back to prevention and get it more in line with the efforts on treatment and recovery. So just wanted to let you know that we locally have had an impact on the state's direction
and
for
the
strategic plan.
And you're on that commission,
plan.
Right?
Yes.
Thank you for doing that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Did you watch the news this morning, that doctor that's up? He's up for life in prison for over-prescribing opioids.
Opioids, right.
830-something charges, or 50-something charges against him for over-prescribing. He said, well, gee, well, I'm at in excess of 500,000 pills from one doctor.
It's terrible.
Opioids.
So on the LADPC, or the Sean Martinez and the prevention, so my first year, they asked me, it was February 2018, that the commission allowed me to go with the prevention team to D.C. for their prevention conference as their liaison. What I learned at that conference is prevention costs a community an eighth of what treatment costs.
Yeah, why put them in a program if you can stop it
before it starts.
Absolutely.
And it's not just someone who's never tried, but it is intervening early on and dealing with that message. So if, as a community, prevention had an impact and we're spending an eighth less than what we have to spend on treatment and having a safe outcome, it's a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Moving down to our custody alternatives program, the big number that you guys like to see, I think, is the estimated jail dollars saved. And in this quarter, we saved $172,100 for our jail and cost avoidance. Significant custody alternative division notes, our CAP supervisor vacated and we are now in the transition plan, which is implemented. Not fully yet. We're still recruiting for a lead case specialist position. And the last bullet point is that we're seeking a new contract to help with the railroad cleanup in partnership with public health. This got brought to our attention through public health, and then it was vetted through our legal department. They're requesting that we provide some work crew services to help clean up some of the railroad that goes through here in Josephine County. So we're in conversation with those leaders.
Is the railroad part of the conversation?
Yeah.
I noticed yesterday when I went to Medford that Josephine County road crew was deep into Jackson County because we're contracting with ODOT.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And we go where ODOT sends within a certain mile. But we were pretty deep into Jackson County and doing road cleanup, which I have no problem with because I don't care who picks the litter up as long as it goes away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we entered into a contract. I think we extended it 10 years last year with ODOT. And, we're cleaning up lots of trash.
I would like to see us on it coming in. I came in from O'Brien, and boy, the 199, there is just litter from one end of that to the other, but that's a tough one. That's on Interstate 5 where, you know, you've got ample room to say, hey, there's a cleanup crew up ahead. Mm-hmm. You've actually got to almost block a lane of traffic on 199. That's not easy to do.
Yeah.
I don't know how that's going to get cleaned up. That's not your issue. That's ODOT's issue.
I like the idea of the railroad. We heard there was concerns over in between Agnes and Mill Street and different portions, M Street, the Parkway, and safety behind the jail and transients and different stuff like that. So it'd be great if they will allow us to do that.
Well, and it's timely because for the first time in a long time, I saw the railroad clean up and mow along their tracks late spring. And so there's a head start. It's not like the 5 and 8 foot berry bushes. It's down a bit, and we might as well keep it down.
Yeah,
it'd be nice because it's rare when you see them come through and do it. It was when after they did all the railroad tie replacement, which is a fun machine to watch if you ever get to see that. It's all mechanical. They had, especially on E and F Street where we'd had a lot of transient issues. They took it all the way down. I'm like, nice.
Yeah.
About time.
Yeah.
I watched them lift a locomotive up over the Poplar, around Poplar over there one time. The locomotive split the rails and sank into the roadbed. I don't know how in the heck you're not going to get a forklift to lift that thing up. And they have a crane car that drives up, and it's just got a crane on it, sits on the track.
Isn't like that something?
But it has so many turns. You know, you always, when you learned about a block and tackle and more turns, you know, like a winch, it's a two-part line, you double. If it's an 8,000-pound winch, it's 16 if you go through one pulley, and 16 again and again and again and again. This thing had so many winds on it, couldn't count it all. Huh. It moved so slow, but it just lifted that whole locomotive up with very little effort.
Huh.
It was amazing. Pretty and impressive. They put the rails back there and set that locomotive right back down on it.
Wow.
Crazy wild.
Yeah.
Antiquated.
Yeah.
It's like being the guy that polishes all the scales on a dinosaur. Anyway.
That concludes my quarterly report. Any questions for me that I can bring back to the...
No, go ahead.
No, you... Go ahead.
I'm really concerned with your third shop at BAP. I want you to really concentrate on that. We cannot afford to lose that next audit.
Yeah.
And I think you've got all the cards in play that can see to it that when they come back, you're going to really turn some heads. That, wow, if we didn't know how you could turn that around that path. So I think that's good.
On that note, what sets us up for that specific audit criteria is that we're using community corrections dollars to pay for the treatment in a tune of about $470,000 for the biennium. So our goal with the migration of one electronic platform to another is to get that treatment division completely independent financially from CCA funds. So we can use the CCA funds just to fund community corrections and their programming. Treatment there's another funding source for treatment specific, and that's through
OHP. So treatment won't threaten the whole program.
Right, right, it won't. If we can get them completely independent, then we only have to get through one audit, which is OHA, and not the core community corrections program checklist. We don't have to go through that. It's only the OHA credentialing and certification process that we would have to go through, which we're fine with. And OHA gives us our credential, and we can provide treatment. But that's my goal, is to shore up, because oftentimes there's conflicting requirements between the CPC and OHA, which creates a whole nother, and I'm getting into the weeds here, but it creates a whole nother dynamic when we're shifting programming to satisfy one audit when the other audit says something different. So that's the long game. The end approach is to get them completely out of community corrections dollars, and then we don't have to worry about CPC. So
I have one question for you on the public health railroad cleanup.
Yes.
The funding for that contract, is it through Solid Waste Agency, Environmental Health?
We'll absorb it through work crews, and then we'll charge them the same rate at $450 a day. So
them being?
The railroad.
Got it. Yeah. So railroad will pay for it.
That's the plan for now. And again, we're in conversation on how all of that is going to look. It hasn't been brought before you as a board to sign the contract yet, but we'll work all those details out.
Well, the railroad has been a conduit for years for transits. Right. You know, it used to be called, we're going to ride the rods. Mm-hmm. And the hobos. I mean, there was a hobo camp out in Devil's Slide when I was a little kid. There was hobo camps there. Up a foundry, there was hobo camp.
I used to do home visits walking down the tracks.
Yeah. And yeah,
the train doesn't come. Right. Yeah, and all of a sudden you come and find a tent in a little burrow. Okay, that's so-and-so's place.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Good point. Because that's really, it seems to be an attractor. I don't know why, but, you know.
Yeah, and so that was our concern as well, is safety for our clientele as well as our personnel. And we have to work out all those logistics in terms of having people readily available to respond to any type of a threat and have access for backup if we need it, and have an escape route if there is some kind of a crisis or a threat out there.
When we were with the city council, they had all those rail cars parked along through town. And that's where our homeless were staying. They were sleeping underneath the cars, they were sleeping in the cars. And we contacted the railroad and said, why are they here? Oh, well, we have those. Why? But the wheels were rusty. They'd been there that long. So we called them and told them, hey, you've got your new storage yard up there by Winchester turnoff on I-5. That's where you go store your cars, not in downtown Grand Pass. And they did move them. They moved them out. We don't have any mills here. You're not picking up lumber at White Custom Loaders anymore, because we don't do anything out of here, really. So don't store your cars on our siding, because it was really an attractant for the homeless folks. Yeah. So they moved down. I know it sounds cold-hearted to move their house north 80 miles, but it happened.
Yeah. Gotcha. Okay. Anything else for me?
Thank you for all you do.
Yeah, thank you.
No, it works good. Good luck.
Thank you.
Oh.
Yes, sir.
We had one for one this morning. Jim Goodwin shot a deer over the weekend. Did you get a deer?
I did not.
Okay, well then.
Is season over, or are you still gone?
No, it hasn't. I haven't gone out yet, so.
Oh. Well, we'll expect a report weekly.
That's right. Oh, pressure's on.
Pressure's valid.
Thank you.
See your face.
I've never participated in those activities. I have
benefited
from the outcome. But so next up is liaison reports. Commissioner Dion?
Yeah, I didn't. Well, last week I was supposed to go out to Illinois Valley to their airport board meeting. They did not have a quorum, so we didn't have that meeting. I did go to the ONC board meeting last Thursday and Friday in Tillamook. We took a field trip up through a logged-off area that Stinson Lumber is doing a very substantial cut And it is a clear cut right above the intake for Oceanside water system. And it was quite interesting because they had a heck of a time convincing Oceanside to log off their watershed, you know, for obvious reasons. But they had a very good program. They laid it all out, how far back from the stream they were going to stay, and monitoring wells and so on and so forth, the whole stretch of this. They were logging while we were there, and everybody was just happier than a pig in new mud. So it was kind of...
Was that state lands, though, or ONC?
No, it was private land. That was private. Yes, it's private land. It's old Crown Zellerbach property, mostly primarily spruce and... What else did they plant in there? But they're going to replant it. The Stinson's a private log, I says. What we would not call it logging. We'd call it roadside vegetation because the trees, their maximum tree is 24 at the butt. Then when the whole log truck went by, I said, well, that's a log truck. And Rocky McVeigh and Tim Freeman, and I said, that's not a log truck. That's toothpicks. But I said, what do you do with those sticks? And they have a small log mill. They make studs. That's all they make is studs out of. So it was pretty interesting. And then we had our meeting on Friday. Quite a lot of chatter about BLM, and we had a representative from Oregon Department of Forestry. He also went on the field trip with us. But the question came up about their debt load at ODF and BLM's response to that. That's just kind of hanging in. It's just one entity that just took all the invoices and just put them in a drawer and closed the drawer. And they're like $100 million that they've paid out that they're not getting back from BLM. So that's that's something to really keep an eye on.
Interesting.
So, yeah, it is very interesting. Mm-hmm. So they were quite concerned about it, but, you know, we'll let those folks that are, you know, with the ODF worry about that. But it's pretty stiff. Report on all the lawsuits. They're still hanging in. We've got one judge back there. And the question came, how old is this judge? You know, we don't have to break another one in. and you know, he's supposed to hear that, I guess, somewhere in springtime. But I think we've heard that.
They were heading out in October, though, right?
Right,
Tim Freeman's going out to D.C. in October?
Yeah, Tim's going to go out. And so, you know, waiting for a report back on that to see how things are going back there. But Washington, D.C. moved, as you know, so slow, you know, in getting these things done. And I'm hopeful, you know, we're hopeful. Another thing is that, you know, every time they turn around, they're taking logs. For instance, part of this field trip, we went down to a stream that was rehabilitated, you know, and they were showing how, oh, yeah, we placed all these logs in here, and we did this, you know, for habitat. I said, that looks like marketable timber to me. Well, yeah, this was, but we don't do that anymore. They're taking cull logs and stuff like that and putting them in the stream because they were taking ONC marketable timber instead of sending it through the mill. They were taking it down to the stream and throwing it in the creek bed for habitat. So they've changed that policy. There's just an awful lot of things that I think ONC, and it's not rightfully so, but ONC really needs to stay in the room because I think ONC counties and their participation according to the ONC Act continually gets ignored. It's not even, you know, like for instance, the road decommissioning. If the road decommissioning box or limits access to ONC land or crosses ONC land, ONC should be in the room ahead of time. But BLM, like we did on the 4 mile road over there, I said, when is this thing supposed to go? And she goes, well, the contract's already been let. I says, and it's already been let. Now you're coming to Jackson County and coming to ONC and asking if it's okay to do it? I said, yes.
So I talked
further. That's kind of the way they do that.
I talked further with Tim Freeman on getting more details when I was in D.C. about that.
Right.
And they're not required to actually go to the ONC Association before they... do those, but they are supposed to come to the counties. The problem is they don't have the lands divvied up between the counties very well, So they started going to ONC so ONC can go through the maps and figure out
which
areas are in which counties, and they don't do it fast enough for them to respond and get back. So I did bring that topic up with both the Department of Interior and the USDA folks back there as far as decommissioning roads and safety concerns and all that kind of stuff. So.
But it's just an interesting. ONC. I think they're definitely needed. I think they're undergunned. You know, I don't know how many people listen to it, but I mean, it's still the ONC app. They can't deny that. But they just kind of pick and choose what parts of it they want to go by. So we had a good exchange. And Tillamook, of course, is. I was just amazed we went to that Tillamook visitor center. Last year they had 1.5 million visitors to that center. And it was its first year.
And that's something.
And it was just amazing. We had our meeting there on Friday, and man, the parking lot was packed with out-of-state plates. And pretty impressive. I went to the market and I was going to get some cheese to snack on in my room. And I started, I almost picked up a package of Kraft cheese.
Don't want to get caught with that.
You show up at the tech stand with Kraft cheese and Tillamook, Oregon.
Yeah, they'll shoot you on the way out.
I'll get you. Grab the Tillamook.
That's hilarious.
Fairgrounds had one meeting. They discussed the logo, and I think that they're working with IT on that to how to make, get the two logos meshed together. I think there's some good conversation there. So I like that. Dan Shepard is going to resign from the board this year.
Oh, yeah?
Well, yeah, so he, but I think they've got some.
Retire, resign, fill his term?
I think retiring, yeah, he's done with his term. He's going to term out. And so he's been a real positive.
Yep.
He's been a real positive feature in that.
We'll have to do something nice.
Gonna miss it.
He's been around a while.
Been a huge
Fairgrounds. I drove out by there the other day. It just looks like Kent City for the stalls, but they seem to be doing just well out there for the horse racing and everything. So I think we're going to be. It's a big move out there.
Yeah, there's a lot of our farmlands out in Redwood that are renting out stalls for people too, because they don't like to be in the tent city. They said they're not getting cleaned out very well.
Well, I think everybody understands.
It's money for the community for renting those out further on.
Yep, and Travis was certain that he was going to be able to get that handled on that end of it. But I think one of the things is I think the horse community is very patient because they realize that if this doesn't work here, it's kind of the end of horse racing in Oregon. It's just like not having a place to race your car. If you built this car and you don't want to support your local drag strip, you won't have a place to go. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to work out all right.
Yeah. So. And I think places like the Grange and Farmers,
yep.
and all those
Thursday, and I'm not sure exactly what time, is the reopening of the Sand Creek Bridge.
Oh, yay.
So they're going to have a ceremony out there. Jason's going to kind of orchestrate that through Public Works. And that's it for me.
Very good. Well, I was surprised this morning at 39 degrees.
Oh, my goodness.
And might want to warm up your car and bring a coat. But also the end of fire season was declared, which is a big deal.
And that begins the beginning of no burn days.
Right.
So you can't take all your...
Yeah,
all the slash you
overlaps
gathered,
with the fog.
Sorry, no burn days.
Yep. I do suspect that in the future we're going to see a little more smoke in the spring and the fall, and hopefully a lot less in the summer, as they try and do some forest management. I had a chance to go to the coast this weekend, and there's that spot in Northern California by the casino where they say careful elk crossing. There's some huge fields there. Well, there was a couple cars stopped, and you figured it was for the elk, but I've never seen this group before, and I've been by there quite a few times. They had probably a dozen juveniles, a dozen cows, and then one absolutely huge buck, maybe 3 foot tall, Bull, exactly.
And the horns would be 6 foot
just
tall.
Just huge. I was like, man, how are you holding your head up? That was amazing. So people were getting, and about 30 feet from the road, so people were getting some good pictures.
There's a little house on the right-hand side there, a little flat roof house. Mm-hmm. And Pam and I stopped there one day because there were 7 big bulls.
I mean, golly.
Not little bulls, but every one of them was a shooter in my book. Right. And there was 7 of them bedded down in that guy's yard right next to his house. I went, whoa. You got to be kidding me. Yeah. You could throw a rock at them. That's impressive to see, you bet.
That was true. It's pretty cool. Let's see. I did go to Eugene last week for a couple days for the Workforce Oregon annual conference. They had some pretty good speakers there. There was one guy from Apple that was really throwing up the flag on education, saying, hey, we've done K through 12 for almost 100 years, and we're not moving quick enough with the way the future looks. He said the method in the past was you went to school the first time, they gave you a little basket, and they started giving you little eggs of knowledge that you had to take home and study, and then someday you're going to be asked to give those eggs back to the teacher. And that was the method of teaching. He said, it's not that way anymore. We don't teach like that. It has to be interactive. It has to be faster. It has to feed your passions and your interests. And we're not moving in those areas. And I know there's a lot of workforce things that are trying to reach from adult back to high school and grab some kids, but I think we really need to work on middle school and high school and even elementary school and think about it all over again about, hey, what are we doing? Why are we doing it? And is it giving us the outcomes we want? And he's, of course, on board. No, it's not. It's not giving us workforce-ready people. One of the nuggets
Linda
I...
Linda Schatz said that from really? SOU, that they actually need to change how they teach teachers to teach.
Yes, and it's going to be a hard transition because you're fighting a powerful union and a method, and then you're going to get the waves of retirement of the baby boomers, and so it's a big concern coming up, and we're going to have to be more nimble as a nation, as educators and workforce development preparers. On the way back from that, I stopped by the Wolf Creek community meeting, which more people at that than in a Cave Junction City Council meeting. There's probably 28, 30 people there, all with good information. But the common thread was kind of the abandoned cars. We're getting them a lot here, and then they move them once maybe after they're abandoned and tear them apart or burn them or whatever. And we're not getting the response we want out of Oregon State or out of BLM or out of Josephine County. And we were saying, well, then you got to keep calling the sheriff deputy out there, the resident deputy, saying you got to keep calling and telling us that they're there. Don't give up because we may not show up tomorrow, but we will show up eventually. We'll get the tow company to come get it or whatever it takes, and we'll help you figure out whose jurisdiction it is. But that's one of their main problems for I took away from that meeting.
May I ask a question
sure,
on that?
Yeah.
I still wonder about having a CSO type position to handle that kind of stuff.
Volunteers.
He's got the auxiliary volunteers that do handicap parking patrol and vacation checks. Is there any other body other than the resident deputies that can do that?
They could respond to that. Yeah.
Or, I mean, all right, we're going to have parking go to the CSO, and he's going to do that full time because it's enough of it and all the properties, and then the deputy's freed up to do other stuff? Or is it, no, the deputy's the best one to do it? I'm just curious because City has 5 or 6 CSOs now, and they handle traffic crashes. They handle, if there's not injury, they handle the parking complaints. They handle the abandoned vehicles and tag them and get them towed, and it frees up the officers to have other things. I know we just breached it barely with the sheriff's office, and but I want to make sure that we're being responsive to the community needs up there.
Mm-hmm. Let's put some stuff together. Let's get some stuff together. I don't know if we need to do it. But what the requirements are, because every time it gets to motorhomes, travel trailers, and automobiles, they have a VIN number. And that steps into a whole different can of worms because you don't just go tow it. You know, you've got to find that VIN number on it. And a lot of times that's the reason they stole the car, is to take the VIN off of it. and pass it, you know, they file for a lost title on a VIN, and they get a VIN and a title, and now they can sell that. Especially in your classic cars, you don't have any idea if that's a car that came out of the factory. But there's a lot of background on that. But you're right. They're sometimes I think it'd be a company like Cascade Auto Recyclers to have a crusher that just goes out to, like, say that grab that or the county property in Wolf Creek. There's half a dozen old cars down there that were all stolen. Find out the disposition. Hey, this car is never going to come back. It's been paid for, covered by the insurance, so therefore, it's an abandoned vehicle and it's already been totaled out, and restitution been paid to the person that was stolen. They don't want it back, of course. Hey, we found your car, and now we want you to give the money back. No, they've already been that case is closed according to the insurance company. So how do we close it with DMV? Yeah. And get it scored.
Was the sheriff at that meeting, or
no,
just his
this
resident
is
deputy?
Resident deputy. Unfortunately, I forget his name.
I don't know it either.
I know Simon out in Cape Junction, but I can't remember.
I don't remember who the
Wolf Creek
other
he covers
ones
Merlin all the way up.
Yeah,
but
it's been a consistent message, and I'm wondering how do we track best that we're and.
Yeah.
Who's the right conversation?
I don't know
if
the sheriff is having trouble finding money to pay those tow companies to do it, or to store them, or finding auto wreckers that'll take them. I know the motorhomes and trailers are always a loser for everybody all around, and so they're the tough ones. You got to give your tow company a few good ones to get them to take that one. But I still think it's a conversation, because $75 to $100 for a tow on one of those could mean a lot to a couple neighbors. That's a lot of money. But to the whole county, maybe we could find a way to take care of some of those vehicles. And I don't know if that's through the sheriff or through our building and planning. Depends on where they land.
We're not charged for those except for the trailer RV ones, I think. The state police set up a rotating tow.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it's part of that program that if they're on the rotation list, they also are called for abandoned vehicles.
There's
a process of a program that some agencies have set up to deal with them.
Yeah, the state police representative was there, a lady, I'm not sure of her name, but she was saying we have a tendency to burn out our tow truck drivers. Mm-hmm. If we make them take too many of the motorhomes, they'll jump off the list.
Sure.
But
go, I don't want it.
If
yeah.
you get somebody like, for instance, Tom Palazzolo, or, you know, he's not the caveman toy, he's not
yeah.
toys, he's not, you know, he's just got a, he's got one wrecker. Dixon Towing is one that just hauls a lot of mm-hmm. stuff out there at the industrial park. I see him in and out of there all the time. And if you said to him, okay, we're going to contract with you, and you three independent towing rigs that aren't out to hit the I-5 stuff, and they can't yeah. do the rollovers for big
aren't
trucks.
All rolled into AAA. And
they're
all.
Not in. They're not into any kind of organization. But we're going to pay you $75 a car to just go get this stuff and get it processed and over to Cascade Auto Recycling.
Let's not offer that yet, because we're not having to do it right now. They'll yeah, take
right.
them right now. The
but
cars.
Maybe
it's
the
just
future,
the RVs
yeah.
that we
it's
have
RVs
to still work
the
thing. But the cars they'll yeah. take, and the sooner they're called, there's still value for resale if they need.
Right,
if we wait for them to be burned out and abandoned. So that's why the sooner the citizens call, the sooner we get a response and get them tagged for tow, and we get them out of there appropriately.
Yeah, and they, of course, have community concerns as well, especially people that come and stay at the inn. This place is beautiful. The inn is awesome. And then they want to sit on the back porch, but then maybe there's a gunshot or a fist fight across the street over where there's a kind of encampment by the overpass. And they're saying it's tough to get return customers to talk good about us when they leave. And so they're... I'm surprised there isn't a stronger neighborhood watch up there, considering
that's
some of the individualistic
cultural
nature.
Thing.
It is a little bit of a... And it's hard to combat. I understand that. But it's also happening right in the middle of their community, so it's hard to miss. You know, it's not like it's happening off on the railroad tracks down
the
street.
Well, it sounds like they have good participation up there, and that's the first step.
That is.
If you got a community yeah. that doesn't give a rip, you're yeah. fighting a losing battle.
They do care.
They do.
I think there's yeah. some intimidation by some groups, that some folks are in fear of that intimidation.
Sure.
But they're trying to have a voice of saying, how do we be safe? How do we take care of our community?
Yep. So, yeah, it's one we got to keep an eye on, and I think they are really showing up and caring, and we want to keep that connection going. Then I went to, well, the last one from Eugene, that workforce One of the stats that came out of there was from the head of our Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I think she gets it. She was saying that only 30% of the jobs that are available in the United States today require some sort of college degree, whether it be 2-year or 4-year, only 30%. And so we got to get off the bandwagon of telling people you have to go to school and assume that debt, when there's really some great trade jobs, apprenticeship jobs, and just getting your hands dirty working type of jobs that are now available that pay good. And so I was glad to see her starting to turn a corner on that have to go to college, have to go to college, have to go to college. Only 30% of the jobs require a degree. And then I went to a manufacturing summit over in White City, a cool building there at the college that I had never been to, even though I've sent a few apprentices there to be trained over the years as electricians. And they're talking about spreading out the apprenticeships to involve some medical, some home care services, to try and get some certifications to get the wages up a little bit.
When you're talking apprenticeships, are you talking union apprentice? And I'm going to be turning in the old. Okay.
No, I'm talking.
That's every time RCC. I hear the word apprenticeships, I think of the union, and then I'm going to work for 5 years, then I'm going to become a journeyman, and I'll continue to pay union dues till the day I die.
Yeah.
But you're talking apprenticeships as being vocational.
Yeah, outside of the union. The unions are really only strong in municipalities and teachers, but in construction, they're on the decline nationwide because of staffing trouble and because non-union has kind of caught up in a lot of ways with wages and benefits just because of the market. There aren't that many workers. But the highlight of that summit for me was a couple of three guys talking about artificial intelligence and augmented reality. They're taking the augmented reality part, they're taking these $5,000 goggles that, let's say you're working on a wind turbine somewhere in the middle of nowhere, and you don't quite have the expertise to troubleshoot that, you can get an IT guy at the factory to look through your glasses and start drawing on your glasses and show you, oh, check out this valve, it should read 37. Check out this one, it should read that. And so they're augmenting the reality in front of you to make you a better technician. And they can do that in so many different areas. They're really exploding. A lot of military stuff, they're doing it. And then a lot of bigger companies are starting to use it to train their workforce. It was pretty cool.
The timer's ticking. Please cut the green wire.
Yeah. And the lens is making it look a little blue.
I don't see green. And you're in trouble.
But the prices on that is plummeting. It's at $5,000 now. They expect it to be down at $2,000 soon. And then virtual reality is mostly entertainment, but they're trying to move it into industry. And those prices are coming down.
Can you imagine
too.
Looking while they're operating on you and there's a team of doctors looking through those goggles going, oh my gosh, don't touch that.
Yeah.
You know, that's exciting technology.
The last guy that did a surgery for medical, he had like 4 robots, the goggles like that on, and he didn't touch the patient.
Yeah.
They were making the cuts and near the spinal cord and all that.
You see him with the fingers and stuff and the robots doing it all. Mm-hmm. But the guy may be a little bit nervous and that robot takes all that out of it. And it's just steady as she goes. It's crazy.
It's pretty exciting. And Southern Oregon has got some skin in the game. We got some companies that are that big and that are developing that technology. Saw a sunglass. I guess he's more of an enhancer. He doesn't actually make sunglasses. They have 70 employees in talent. And they make coatings for sunglasses for all the big companies.
Oh, wow.
And little tiny, you know, thousandth of an inch style coatings that change the surface and make it more protected or more light sensitive. And the culture in those companies is what they're both conferences talked about is, you know, making it flexible hours for your employees, offering education, showing them the path to success, the career pathway within your company. And I'm trying to transfer that. Each speaker, I'm asking, well, how does that translate to a municipal situation? How can you work on culture there? And he says, well, it's a lot harder, but you got to pick some low-hanging fruit. Something good like either just having lunch in a department where you don't know anybody as a commissioner and going, what's going on? What problem are you guys working on? What are you going to do tomorrow? And sitting down at a lunch situation or something like that to where you're just starting to, well, let's at least talk. I know we can't maybe have a big event with zip lines and karaoke machines and all that, but maybe we could sit down and talk about how things are going and start seeing a little bit of movement in these municipal situations where you can't provide beer pong tables or you can't provide a kegerator in the break room like you can at some other private business.
And the problem is?
I'm sure our legal team would have some problem. We wouldn't even have to ask.
Yeah, bring your mug.
Anyway, I had a good time last week doing those things, although I got a little bit conference burnt after 2 days in Salem and then one in Medford. And I was like, all right, I want to go back to work and see what's going on in my office. So it was fun.
I understand that one. So we were, Sarah and I, as you know, were asked to go speak at the House Energy and Environment Committee 2 Wednesdays
emergency
ago.
Emergency Management, Sarah?
Sarah, Emergency Management, okay. Sarah, on the public safety power shutoffs. Mm-hmm. We had worked to come up with a presentation with some very specific asks and needs from the state, some concerns that we have. For instance, Pacific Power asked us to provide the locations of vulnerable citizens, facilities, and infrastructure as far as who's medically dependent. Nobody tracks that locally.
Yeah, how could we do that?
So we reached out to Oregon Health Authority. They don't track it statewide. They kind of know with your local CCO, maybe All Care, where they're having people in their homes, maybe, but it's not being tracked. And then we're told you can't share that information with Pacific Power because it's protected
privacy.
By HIPAA. And so those were some of the things that we brought up to the state, that in order to make sure that these people are identified for where they are vulnerability, that a service is provided to them or a shelter is brought to them, because Red Cross will not deploy for power shutoff. If it's an emergency or a natural disaster, Red Cross will just deploy, but they will not for an intentional shutoff. So now that's back on Pacific Power to provide a shelter with heat or air conditioning for oxygen.
I brought up that because why don't they just have a program to put in a genset for those people? And then they don't have to haul anything out there. It automatically takes over a no-interest, zero-interest program to say, you need this in your home. Your doctor says he has to stay on oxygen. All his medication needs to be refrigerated. He can't handle the heat, and just walk out. PP&L takes it. The county doesn't have anything to do with it. The state doesn't.
We are talking to them about that.
And let PP&L do that. It's their shutoff.
That's what we're saying, is that PP&L has to, and not just, but here's the concern. You're not allowed to use small engines in the height of fire season. Generators that are small engines.
But
are a fire risk.
Space. So they're talking make an amendment for that and clear out around it. Yeah. Make a, an
so,
apron.
So they're talking about solar, battery backup, generators, the whole thing of what do you have to do to allow that person. Because Pacific Power is saying their power might be off for up to a week or so. Mm-hmm. So what refrigerator is going to hold cold food that long? None. You know, all that other kind of stuff. So we spoke at the meeting at the Capitol, the Committee on Energy and Environment. And because of our presentation being very specific asks and helps, they asked us to come back and present to the Governor's Wildfire Council. The Governor's Wildfire Council is making a report that's due November 11th that will direct the state policy for the next 10 to 20 years on wildfire practice. It's a big deal to be a part of that committee. And so, again, we gave some specifics there. Pacific Power wanted us to come and talk about that we're doing a private-public partnership and that, you know, it's all about working together as a team. We said, this is our concern, the safety of our community and our citizens.
And this is your program to shut power off.
This still needs to be addressed. So we had that opportunity to speak to that. Both of us were like, oh my goodness, 2 weeks in a row of up and back. And but because of how it was presented and the specific asks, we're told that it was heard and hopefully will be implemented into policy.
Yeah.
And some helps that can come from that.
I think it would be helpful if you just like when I said generators, said, nope, they can't run it during fire season, then make those amendments, make those requirements going in that a guy gets his generator and he's in the woods, fine, that he has to, around that part of the installation is a 20-foot apron of gravel or something of that sort.
And we are absolutely looking at...
And they shut the power off. They also shut the guy's well off. So now he can't protect his home.
Yeah, we've already talked to Pacific Power about that and the liabilities and the concerns. Had our meeting yesterday. Sorry, I was trying to remember what today was. With county people about getting the BLM exchange. So we're going to make sure the maps are specific and identifiable and our list. We're going to bring that to you guys just to make sure we're on the same page. I also need to get a sign off on ONC Association.
I was going to say what I would like to see exactly what that final list is and how it affects ONC land.
Yes. Okay. There's three properties that are ONC properties. Lake Selmac, a second Lake Selmac, and Enos Riffle, a little strip. Uh-huh. So we'll have exact acreage.
Wildlife Images in on that, or do they draw
it's
that?
It's not ONC.
That's no ONC.
I'm just saying the three ONC.
It's still in the conversation.
None of that really has any marketable stuff on it anyway, does it?
So we're going to make sure we get all that to you guys.
Okay.
The exact locations, so ONC can weigh in.
Selmac might have some.
We just have to check with ONC. Right. Then we are going to get it to a public hearing and get feedback again for a second public hearing and then kind of go from that route. So wanted to give you an update of where we are with that.
And let me go back before you cover another one. The Pacific Power de-energized zones, they said something about, it'll only be for a few hours, and we haven't done it but once or twice in 20 years. Maybe it was once. And I said, I don't believe you on the hours. That's not going to happen.
They told me a week.
And I know. See, different information. Yeah. And I just saw that they shut it down in the San Francisco area to 24,000 customers based on weather. They did one of these de-energizes. Huh. And I don't know what the effects were. Hopefully they're studying it for that area. But that's an indicator that maybe it may happen more often than they're promising.
Would you like us to, I'll get to Annette so she can get to you guys, the list that Sarah and I gave them of recommendations?
Yes, yeah. I would like to see that. You present it to everybody else, present it to us.
I would be happy to.
That'd be great. I do appreciate your work on that council too, by the way.
I know it's been a lot of time, commitment, and I think because of the last two summers, made it a higher priority.
Yeah. It's a once-in-a-lifetime chance to get in on a change. This could be a big change.
Correct. And policy for the next 10 to 20 years impacted by it.
Absolutely.
Okay, so followed up with Keijo and confirmed with Brenda that they're going to give a third Tuesdays of every month to county programs and departments. And then the fourth will be the Commissioner's Day so that... City has council on the first Tuesday, and then they have staff and programs on the second Tuesday. County staff and programs will be the third Tuesday. Commissioners will be fourth Tuesdays. Then Keijo will keep the fifth. When there is a fifth Tuesday, they're going to keep that for themselves.
Who notifies the county programs that they'll be up on Keijo Radio?
So they've asked us to get a list of contact information, and I had suggested that we not just do department heads, but that we actually look at programs. For instance, public health might be one department, but under public health, you have environmental health, you have the solid waste guy working with planning, you have WIC, animal shelter and licensing, and immunization. I mean, you got all these different programs and divisions, and one or two of those could take up the whole time.
Right.
So that if we give them the department head and programs available. For instance, Jim this morning came in and talked about school outreach officers and prevention. Sean Martinez could probably take a whole hour and talk about prevention and the school outreach programs under her, but that's a part of juvenile. It's not. So they said that they wanted to have the contact list so that if something came up timely, that they can go straight to and say, could you be on this one? But they also would be open for us creating the schedule.
Right.
And so they also said that by them having the contact list, that if they had an opening on that fifth Tuesday and they wanted to fill in a program, that then they could contact a program and said, would you come speak on Keijo?
Right.
So Annette was going to work with her staff to come up with a list of programs and contact information. And we can come up with a calendar.
Right, you can throw it up against the calendar, so fair's next to fair.
Yeah. We tried to do that already of when was airport days.
On one show.
Yep.
Yeah. When is airport days? When is the month before fair?
The kickoff of the park season. Yeah. Maintenance days.
I was wondering about prevention and the school outreach officers for October. Or is there something else going on right now that you guys would like to highlight for October?
No, that sounds as good as any. Unless the sheriff wants to talk about marijuana eradication. He kind of said he didn't want to talk about it until the season was over. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
wait till all the shooting's done.
Yeah.
So we can give them a schedule, but they also wanted the flexibility to be able to call somebody and fill in gaps.
Right.
So if you guys are okay with that.
Yeah, that sounds pretty structural.
And then it puts us back to us being on the fourth one, so we're every month again.
Right.
And instead of it being last Tuesday of the month, keeping it fourth Tuesday of the month, so it's always right before our city-county meeting.
Sounds good.
Yep.
Okay. One of the other things that happened a few months ago is we were having feedback from advisory meeting members of what's our purpose. So we have Board of Health, Mental Health Advisory Board, and LADPC. The last 5 years, there's been a transformation of health system in Oregon to be more holistic, as far as you have the CCOs now that look at coordinated care. So if somebody has mental health issues, they also try to make sure they get to a doctor. They try to make sure they have housing. They try to this coordinated care. But the county has continued to have separate advisory committees that aren't coordinated necessarily. So a few months ago, I met with Carla McCafferty from Options Mental Health, who heads up the Mental Health Advisory Committee, met with Mike Weber from Board of Health, and Sean Martinez, who is LADPC, and we also had Leslie O'Brien. Leslie is on Options Board. She's a former public health director, and she's on the Board of Health. So she covers...
Crosses over a little. Yeah.
And we said, does it make sense that we're continuing to have these separated when our system has gone to this coordinated care system? And so we spent time as a committee looking up state law, what's required, what are the bylaws, what's the background, all that other kind of stuff. And the outcome was, the recommendation was to merge.
Mm.
And to...
have one committee for...
Correct.
Yeah.
So they then worked on merging of bylaws, and it's before legal right now, and legal is verifying with state law, and they're going to bring that back hopefully this month, because they want to get it going that these three can now be working together. Because what you would find is, as the person that's liaison all three, they happen to all meet on Thursday. So every Thursday I'm going to a different meeting,
mm-hmm.
and the same topics are talked about week after week after week in different groups. So it's like, why don't we bring this together and make sure they're all represented here? So that recommendation is going to be coming to you guys after Mike, Carla, Sean, and Leslie made the recommendation that that merge. So they're working on it to bring it to you guys for that recommendation. It has already been presented to all those advisory boards. The only one that was kind of concerned was LADPC. They said, well, we like our culture here. And it's like, okay, but...
Good.
Yeah. So just as an update on where that's at.
Make them go to the other three meetings, and they don't like it quite so well.
LADPC is Local Alcohol Drug Prevention Commission? Council? Something.
Council.
Okay.
Consortium.
It is. So we got an email from Susan Roberts with Association of Oregon Counties that needs a decision and notification this week. And... it's a letter. It says, I don't know if you guys saw this. It's dated September 20th, but I don't know which day we got the email. I just was looking back for something else, and I came across this email I hadn't read yet that said attention needed. And it was sent on Monday, November 23rd. So we're just a week out. But two Mondays from now is our Association of Oregon Counties monthly meeting, steering committee meeting in Salem. They have We pay extra as a county to be a member of the Federal Land Management Subcommittee. And they meet at 7 a.m. usually on that Monday. And this meeting on October 14th, they are going to be approving the 2020 budget. And as a commissioner in good standing, as a county with commissioners in good standing, and we can appoint one voting member to be at that meeting at 7 a.m. to vote. A member county must appoint one of its governing body members to vote on its behalf. The county makes the appointment of its voting member by a letter signed by the majority of the governing body delivered to subcommittee staff when it pays its dues to the subcommittee. If the county changes its voting member, it must do so by letter signed by the majority of the governing body delivered to subcommittee staff. The budget of the 2020 year will be voted on in the Federal Land Subcommittee meeting that will be held on October 14th at 7 a.m. at the local government center as part of AOC Day. To be eligible to vote, I need a letter designating your voting commissioner by that date. Please forward your designation letter to me at your earliest convenience to be eligible to vote on the budget at the October 14th meeting.
Can we nominate from the floor?
We would need to hear, and then we can have a letter.
Okay. I nominate Lily Morgan.
So, are either of you going to AOC up there?
I don't know. I haven't looked at my schedule.
I was planning on it.
Would either of you like to be that person?
It's lands and forest resource or
this, so
something like that.
This is different than the 8 o'clock Natural Resources Committee.
Right.
This is a special committee at 7 a.m. that's just for federal land management.
Oh, okay. I've been to those meetings.
The 7 a.m. one.
You go to that one? You want to do it?
Yeah, I'll go.
Okay. So I nominate Darren Fowler to be our voting member for the federal lands.
That was fast, wasn't it?
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Yep.
Aye. And aye. So motion carries 3-0. So yep. You know, at AOC last year, we had designated me as the state trust lands liaison.
Right.
So you're now the federal lands voting member.
And you're on some other committee as well.
Oh, I'm on lots of committees.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
But as far as our designated for forest trust lands, you're our natural resources commissioner, and if you want it, you should be that person. You may be able to participate by phone, I don't know, but if they're going over the budget there, I don't know how easy it is. So if you're not going, it's great that Darren wants to do it. It keeps each of us kind of involved in natural resources because I think it's important that we all
learn. I think natural resources is a countywide thing.
It is.
We can
assign like economic development.
One to it, but all three of us need to have the same
the knowledge, yeah.
I'm okay with that.
Well, and that reminds me, do we want to set a time, whenever that is, January or something, to look at liaison lists once a year?
We have traditionally done it in November.
That way, okay.
We usually do
that works too.
Up at the conference we did last year.
Oh, and I'm going to miss this year.
So when you,
we can make it.
When you
guys can make it without me.
No, we can make it.
I was wondering where you were heading with that.
No, I've been figuring. We all three got to sit down
so,
and
yeah.
do that.
Yeah.
So we can have a meeting scheduled at the first of the year or at the end of December and then ratified. I just wanted
to make sure it was on the radar.
Well, and I mean, we didn't have discussions this year on a couple areas that we said we were going to. Chair roles and responsibility. No. It's changed every year that I've been here.
Yeah, and things that we were allowing some room for our new executive office manager to fill some of that.
I think that coming into this new year, maybe we should look at liaisons as not what we've all had, but taking a chance to relook at it.
See which ones coordinate well together and with your
talents. Have a whole conversation about where we're at with it all.
And I'd like to have it in two conversations. A proposed meeting, let's start it and talk about it, and then give some time to chew and go,
and is this what we actually went for? But I liked, Annette showed us that format that Klamath used.
Mm-hmm.
I liked that format that kind of showed the different areas of liaison stuff. But what I really liked about it is all three of us signed the bottom as well. It kind of was our...
We've made a decision, not just talked about it.
I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
I kind of like making it official because sometimes it does get blurry. But we should be covering for each other more often as well. If we're missing a meeting for great reason, I'd still like to go whatever you're missing or whatever you're missing, because then I can learn real quick and they still get the attention I think the board needs to give them.
So. Well, and one of the things I realized as well that we've never talked about is we have the monthly manager meetings and the monthly elected official luncheons. They're pre-built in our computers as whose turn it is. But if you miss a month, you don't get plugged in to somebody else's rotation. You just miss your rotation. And so then it's a long time before you do it. And I would recommend that,
I like that.
If somebody fills in, that we then get their next
slot.
Do a
shuffle, yeah.
So that we actually get to stay in the rotation and keep a part of the conversation. But I think that's all stuff that we have the opportunity to talk about. And remembering that liaisons are fluid.
Yep. We're not dying on that hill.
Correct. It can, I mean, it's just one of those things, but that would be something to talk about. Okay, so we got the Federal Lands Subcommittee design.
Can I ask a question? So before we leave the liaison, when do we want to revisit that so that we can make sure we have it on there? Do we want to?
Yeah, is that November, December, or January? When's? I was just asking. I don't know what the best time is.
It'd be a good time in December because we're not doing a whole bunch with the holidays and stuff, and that'd be a good time to just visit the whole
thing. And then ratify in January?
Yeah.
So we can start maybe
at the first
of the beginning
year.
Of December?
Uh-huh, and then ratify in January.
I think that has a nice feel to it.
Yeah.
December is a good month to do that. Okay, that's good. Give us time to make a list as to what we want to discuss, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, touchy points are.
Been there long enough.
There's been some discussion and criticism about the logo and the cost and the out-of-state and the website. And would you as a board be willing to entertain us writing a letter as a full board? I would like to work with John to get some specifics gathered. For instance, when this started, it was a website project, and we were told that we would have to pay to have our old logo digitized to go on the new website.
Right.
And it was in the rounds of $7,000 to $11,000. I don't remember what the cost was. I've asked John for that cost. But we were going to have to pay to have our old logo digitized. So the question came up, do we stick with the old logo that has 11 official colors, details that you can't see, is in various forms? So there was a review and a recommendation to go down a new path. Community stakeholders from all over the valley were brought in outside of the commission to give recommendations and feedbacks of what Josephine County is to them, feedback on the old logo and what they'd be looking for, various things. And based on that, the recommendation was to go down the new path of a logo. The RFP went out to everybody, and of the responses, they picked the top three qualified to do it, two of which appeared to be local. One ended up not being local. The one person lived in Ashland, I think, but their entire staff was either Seattle or LA. And the other one, but with those three, the two local and the one Colorado, we checked references. The group called and followed up with references all over and how it was working with the groups, how it was very, and based on the costs were all comparable. Based on recommendations and quality of what we saw, it was almost unanimously that they went with the Colorado company for what was offered, what was available, and implementation into the website and forms and various things like that. And we as a board had decided to go that route. But I don't know if we've told our story necessarily or if people just understand that we just spent $25,000 for a logo.
I think the thing that I answer when people say, oh, $25,000 for a logo, I just say, whoa, stop right there. This included our website, correct? Not at all.
No, it does include integration with our website.
Okay. Because our website's been a real bone of contention with everybody that tries to use it.
Yes, and we're still in the process of our website.
And portion, I would say that is, this is a prerequisite to revamping our website.
This is what started the process.
That has to happen before we revamp the website.
But instead of it being just one of us and or a Facebook response or this and this and that, it was suggested that, especially with an editorial, that maybe we write back a
I think you need to keep it short and sweet and not talk about stakeholders and all the whole process we went through.
Okay.
But just say, you know, we strive to.
It's more than a logo. Website integration.
Right. We're going to have to pay either way to fix something that's really been a problem all along since all of us have been here.
Okay.
And another thing is that yes, we always strive to use local, but when the three bids came back, we also at that point need to strive to get the best bang for the buck, whether it's local or not. You don't want to use somebody local if they don't have the expertise to do what the Colorado company does every day for a living.
So
I think we can.
If we draft something, can I bring it back to you guys? Would you be open to that?
Really, really simple. I don't think I would go through with the stakeholders and the whole process. And we had people coming in from all over, because they'll say, I never was contacted. Mm-hmm. No, nobody contacted me, and I'm a voice. So just, you know, that we did our diligence. And then when at the end of the day, we got the most bang for our buck for $25,000, and that will now lead us into the website change. It's been so long overdue. This is the first steps.
Yeah.
There've been some people, I think Scott Stoddard makes so much out of so little that it's just not even funny.
No, you know, he's not the only one. There's different communication going on, but I think it comes down to we also have a public information officer, and are we being responsive to questions coming up in the community? Are we responding and engaging? But more importantly, are we making sure the right information is out there, the full picture versus half pictures?
Are we telling our own story or just reacting? Because we have plenty we could talk about that's going on. Yeah.
And we probably...
Well, one of those
conversations... We ought to be proactive on that. Rather than following Scott Stoddard's story, we ought to tell our story first. If we see some controversy coming up, let's get the jump on that guy.
Well, not just him, but in general. I should let you know that there's also questions coming about travel and various things. So I was asking for us to... Let's tell our story. Mm-hmm. Simon was designated in this. This is his travel. This is what we had our travel with Dan and I do in AOC County College. This is our travel for, you know, kind of thing. Tell our travel story. So it's one of those things that we're telling the story of why. What is the benefit of us traveling? What is the benefit of us doing different stuff? And why, you know, why is it the way it is?
And why it's timely right now because of our forest management issues and fire management issues. And so it's timely that we're in those meetings. Mm-hmm.
Going back to your comment about bylaws and whatnot, the airport board, both airport advisory, wants to change their bylaws and review it.
Yeah.
Larry, you know, made the suggestion we could look at both of them and maybe combine the bylaws to cover both airports.
Oh. They're very similar looking.
Yeah, their meeting frequency and things of that, and the makeup of the board. I think it's all over the map for both of them, and I think standardizing would really help us out. But it, you know, it's a bylaw change, so it has to come before the board and legal and everything else. So it would be okay if I told Larry to get started on that.
Yeah, and maybe we next year take all of them and start looking at them, making sure we got updated bylaws and membership and.
Great idea.
We have trouble with membership.
Well, poor Trish has been trying to keep me happy because I've been asking these questions for three years and. But it is one of those things that, with airports, it was like, why does IV have alternates? And they didn't know they're alternates. And it's like, why do we have them? I don't know. Well, why do we need them? I don't know.
And what's the charge of the alternate? I don't know that either. You know, so
when the voting member's gone.
Let's put it in modern day language and a schedule that everybody, because that's where I go out and I'll drive all the way out to Cape Junction once a month. And I'm looking at the same agenda. If it didn't have the date change on the top of it, I probably wouldn't know. We're still talking about runway aprons and taxiways. And there was a.
That's what I felt 2 years ago. I know you guys had concerns of, well, you didn't attend all those meetings. I said, have you seen the agendas that are the same every single month?
I got an email. We got an email from Larry talking about a runway, and it was every bit of it was in airport speak. You would have to be an FBO. Person monitor to understand what the hell he just said.
Yeah.
And I'm going to print it out and I'm going to say, so here it is. And then I'm going to ask him about 1-843-6572. And he won't know what that is. And I go, why? If I'm supposed to know all of these numbers for taxiway, Bravo, Zilo, Zulu, Foxtrot, Libra, Albatross, I go, wait a minute.
What the did you get all that, Trish?
Did you get that, Trish?
I do have... That was a trip to the zoo or something. I have one more liaison thing for you as well. What do you say? Oh, two, actually. So, as the DBE liaison officer...
What's a DBE?
Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Liaison Officer. Okay. It's that special designation for federal transportation dollars that...
Yeah, right, got it.
We are trying to fix past mistakes of... we keep getting reports from the FAA that they need stuff fixed from past years. And so I have a meeting Wednesday with our new engineering firm trying to fix the old engineering firm's stuff.
All right.
So we're trying to get in compliance with FAA stuff, and I wanted to let you know. In that conversation with Larry of trying to set that up, he also mentioned the other one that we've recently had with all those lists and checklists, and he seems hopeful that we're going to get there soon. And that's great news, because then we can get past all that too. So that's Wednesday. One other thing I wanted to... I mentioned to Annette yesterday, we've talked for 2 years of how do we track, when we bring something up in a meeting like this about, hey, we're interested in that, where's the follow-up? How do we track when to bring that back up? Or did we make any progress on that? Or any other projects countywide that we as a board need to be keeping in mind of? And I wondered if, do we need a software? Do we need some kind of system? We've tried in this office a list of all the things on our list of follow-up, but there wasn't something to tick a reminder or a follow-up. And so if you, for me, there's things that randomly come up in a meeting and say, hey, we should talk about that, or we should follow up with this, or what do you think about this?
About the cars in Wolf Creek on the side of the road. Is there any
so follow-up? How do we make sure that doesn't fall off? How are we tracking? And that's one of the things I had hoped that a position with Annette would help.
Yeah, help make that clearer.
But is it a software that triggers a reminder or a... If we look at any project countywide that we're tracking, what's their status? Okay, with the merger of those three advisory committees, it's at legal and we're waiting for a review on the state. Or some way of just, what's the status of that? And I don't know the right answer. Is it an Excel spreadsheet?
We had the same trouble over at the city, remember? Is that what happened to that?
Yep.
What happened to that? What happened to that? Because we didn't hear back.
Yeah.
And so I understand exactly what you're talking about.
So when those topics come up, how does it get on the list, and where was our follow-up? Or where was the... I don't know the right administrative way to do it, but I feel that we need it. And... Yeah.
Right, and if it's not in a person, then is there a dashboard or a tracking system that's available?
Dan could look and say, where's Lily with that... Or where's public health with those
BLM
employees?
Stock.
And
right.
How are we doing with hiring? Or what are those things that we're tracking? And administratively, that any of us could look at and say, okay, that's where that status is. And we can let Annette know, I'd like to talk about that again. Or let's get a report on that. Or something kind of just to drive status updates for us to be aware.
Well, and to have that 47-item thing tracking. It started here, it's right here, and it looks like it might end. Are we done with that?
Is this an interest to you guys? Or is it just me that is kind of feeling we don't know?
I think we've got an awful lot going on, and that would probably help to keep us on track.
Yep. Yep. Just a timeline dashboard with a little...
Something.
Have we checked in on that one? Boy, it's been a while.
Yeah. So is it all right if we have Annette look at what she maybe recommend on how we can do that?
Okay. Yep. I think that's good process to look at.
So I've made it through mine. We kind of did an additional subjects liaison all together.
We did. We ran them all.
Is there anything else we need to cover?
I don't think so.
No.
Are we 9 a.m. tomorrow?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. I just haven't looked yet. Okie doke.
But I have my DBELO meeting at 10 a.m. because... One thing, what I was going to bring up about that meeting with our precision, whoever the engineering firm is, they're coming to town for our master plan at the airport, so we're trying to combine while they're in town to get the both done. So that's the significance of that 10 a.m. was the slot that we could try to get that done based on their other schedule.
Gotcha.
Okay, if there is nothing further, then we can be adjourned at 10:58.